This is not funny. Welcome to Cairo Nights. I'm Jack Stein.
Oh, yes.
Frank Shires in the music. Shane Peterson. Oh, there we go. Thank you.
Shane, why'd you let him touch the turntable?
Hey, you know what? It just happens sometimes.
He's just so grabby.
Welcome to Cairo Nights. I'm Jack Stein. Frank Shires in the newsroom. Shane Peterson, formerly on the ones and twos. We're going to be looking for a new board op here pretty soon. We're going to be talking about the George Floyd case, because I don't think that anybody's... I don't think it's going the way that most people think that it is going. But before we get to that, Frank Shires,
yes, sir.
Outside of that ruse, outside of that caprice, sir, how are you doing this evening?
I'm in fine spirits. Thank you.
I'm more disappointed than you will ever know that you guys use the one piece of music that I share with you. I bare my soul to my friends, Frank Shires and Shane Peterson. I say the worst piece of music I have ever heard of in my life is Maneater by Hall & Oates.
Yeah.
And what do you do with my vulnerability?
I didn't do
what
it.
Do
we
you
pick
do?
On it.
And we pick on it. You know that scab that's been, we pick it off.
All right, gentlemen. Well, on that note, let's just get right into the recap then, since nobody wants to just do pleasantries. We'll just get right into the recap. Shane, take it away.
Sounds good, Jack.
Jack's recap. Today's biggest headlines in 15 minutes or less.
There's something in the air right now about the Derek Chauvin case. There's something going on right now with media, with just people on the ground, people on Facebook. There's something going on. It's almost as if there is a tension a-brewing. I see it on social media. I see it in mainstream media. There's something going on that I think is going to end in catastrophe. I hope it doesn't. I hope that we're all able to be adults about the Derek Chauvin trial. I hope that we can all discuss what happened to George Floyd like adults. We can have emotions around it. We can have strong feelings around it. But my hope is that we would be able to talk about it in such a way that doesn't end in rioting and violence. And when I look at what's going on right now with mainstream media, I'm thinking that that is not going to happen. I'm thinking that in a couple of weeks, there is going to be hell to pay because people are not going to get the result that they want from the Derek Chauvin case. You know, I was thinking about today, I was just thinking about the show, and a thought came to me out of nowhere. I wrote my senior thesis for college on how information is disseminated, how information is distributed through social media. How do the algorithms work was the primary focus of my thesis. And before anybody came out and said, oh, well, there are information silos and there are echo chambers, I wrote my thesis on that very idea. I said to myself, how is it that Twitter or Facebook or YouTube is able to keep people looking at the platform for the longest amount of time so that they can expose them to the most amount of advertising? And I thought to myself, well, the only way that I would do that is if people were talking to people who agreed with them. If people were exposed to things that they agreed with, that they found to be pleasurable, that they found to be affirming, because most people psychologically want to be affirmed in their beliefs. That was my thesis. I wrote it. I submitted it. Hey, A plus. Congratulations, Jack Stein. And then about 3 or 4 weeks later, the chief technical officer of Facebook came out and he said exactly how they do it. They say we separate people based on things that affirm their feelings about the world. That is how we get people to spend 5-6 hours a day on Facebook, 3-4 hours a day on YouTube. This is how we get people to spend time on Twitter. Fascinating that the way that they keep people engaged with social media is not necessarily to show them the facts of the case or the information of the case, but the things that they will agree with the most. And because of that, I think that in a couple of weeks, if Derek Chauvin is not found guilty, people are going to literally explode. Because a promise has been made by mainstream media and by social media. The promise that was made was, we will cover the news and Derek Chauvin will be found guilty. And then everything will be right in the United States. That is the narrative that is currently trying to be carved out. And I don't see it happening. I think based on the standards of reasonable doubt, I think that Derek Chauvin is going to get acquitted for the murder of George Floyd. I think he's going to get off, and I think that there is going to be hell to pay. Because these very young kids who are all hopped up on BLM and they're all hopped up on this idea of no justice, no peace, no racist police, they are so primed for this. And it is so irresponsible of my contemporaries in media to keep talking about the case as if it is a slam dunk. I have many clips pulled from CNN, from MSNBC, from NBC that I'm not even going to play. I'm not even going to go through them because they are so egregious. And they are so counter-narrative, if you will. They are so counter-factual to what's actually going on that if you heard them, you would get an entirely different impression than what is going on in this case. What's going on right now, effectively, is the prosecution is just falling apart. If you sit down and actually watch the case unfold over time, you are watching the prosecution's case completely fall apart. There's a reason why the standard in criminal law is reasonable doubt. I took one semester. I'll be totally upfront with you on this. I took one semester of criminal law when I was in college to get my degree. But the professor was a former prosecutor who had ended up being a defense attorney. And he hammered it into our brains in this introductory to criminal law course. He hammered it into our brains. A reasonable doubt. Beyond a reasonable doubt. He just kept saying it over and over and over again. He hammered it into our brains because there were people in the class who considered themselves to be activists. They considered themselves to be, oh man, what's going on with the case of Philando Castile or Tamir Rice? And they considered themselves to be young, up-and-coming Benjamin Crumbs. They wanted to be the next defining civil rights lawyer. That's the way that they viewed themselves. And this professor took the time to really say, listen, this is the way that the law works. And it doesn't matter what you know, it matters what you can prove. He actually stole that from Training Day, and I called him out on it. He says, it doesn't matter what you know, it matters what you can prove in court. And right now, in court, it's beginning to look more and more as if George Floyd died from an overdose than anything else. All of the evidence keeps coming out. There are partially masticated pills that they found in the squad car that he was kept in that have his DNA on them. He has enough fentanyl in his system to kill two or three people. He's got amphetamines in his system. He's got something like 75% arterial blockage in his heart. All of this would suggest a reasonable doubt. You could disagree with it. You could be texting in right now furiously, 9973, and you could be saying, Jack Stein, how dare you take that position? I actually agree with you, person who's upset right now. I agree with you. I actually think that a failure of the state killed George Floyd. I think he needed medical attention. I think he needed Narcan. I think he was mistreated by the police. And I'm very upset when I see that video of him literally dying in the street. I'm on your side. I'm an advocate for George Floyd. I think he needed medical help. I think he needed to be taken out of there immediately. There's a new piece of audio that has come out, which again, I will not play because it is so difficult to listen to. But there is a piece of audio of George Floyd saying, I ate too many drugs. He says, I ate too many drugs. Now, some people are saying that he's saying, I ain't got any drugs. That may be the case, but for me, as someone with a trained ear, it sounds like he is saying, I ate too many drugs. And it's really sad to listen to. So all of these things keep piling up. And you can't take the perspective of saying, well, I know what happened to George Floyd. And if I don't get the end result that I want, I'm going to go riot out in the street. We have to think about this in terms of the way that the law sees it. So if we're going to have this big emotional outpouring in a couple of weeks and rioting in the streets, I'm thinking to myself, how could we possibly regroup as a country if this case doesn't go a particular way? This is such a tricky case. This is worse than OJ. This is worse than the Michael Brown case. You know, part of my thesis when I wrote it in college was I focused deeply on the Michael Brown case. If you're not familiar, Michael Brown was 18 years old, and he and a friend of his committed a strong armed robbery at a convenience store for cigarillos. They're walking down the street and there's an officer. His name is Darren Wilson, and he is responding to that call. One of the customers in the store called 911. So he sees these two guys. He sees Michael Brown walking down the street, and he slows down and he tells them, hey, get out of the street, because they are literally walking down the middle of the street. all of a sudden he realizes, oh, hey, those might be the two guys who did the strong arm robbery. So he pulls the car around and he goes to open his door to get out. And what does Michael Brown do? Michael Brown charges the car door, slams himself against the car door, pushing Darren Wilson inside of the police car. Michael Brown then punches Darren Wilson, reaches for his gun. The gun discharges, striking Michael Brown in the thumb. Michael Brown reels away from the car, runs about 30 yards away from the car, and then he stops. Darren Wilson gets out of the car. Darren Wilson, with his firearm, Officer Wilson pulls the firearm. He tells Michael Brown to get down. Michael Brown turns around, runs right towards Darren Wilson. He gets shot 4 or 5 times, and he tragically dies in the street. That is the sequence of events from an 1,100-page grand jury report that has ballistics reports. It's got pictures. It's got blood spatter. It's got blast residue from the gun. I mean, they have everything in this grand jury report, and it's available for you to read right now. But for some reason, the narrative around Michael Brown is the whole hands up, don't shoot narrative. How many times have you heard that? Hashtag hands up, don't shoot. That myth comes from a woman who was not there, who did not see the event. She showed up afterwards, and she sees Michael Brown in the street, and she sends one tweet where she says something to the effect of, oh my God, another one of our young ones gunned down in the street, hands up, don't shoot. And within 24, 48 hours, that had been retweeted something like 10,000 times. And that is where the myth of hands up, don't shoot comes from. How do I know this? Because I spent a week and a half of my life researching this and reading the grand jury report. All of the information is in there. Everything that you would ever want to know about trajectory of the bullet over, you know, square inches, or the blast radius from inside of the car, or the bruise radius on Darren Wilson's face. It's all in there. Excruciating, excruciating detail. And yet, we still have this myth around Michael Brown, the death of Michael Brown. And it's very tragic and it's very sad. And we will likely never know why Michael Brown decided to charge Darren Wilson. But if we go on, let us say, Vox.com, for example, and we look at what they say about it, is they say that he was just flat out execution murdered in the street. Is that a lie? Is that an obfuscation? Is that them trying to make some kind of weird point about Michael Brown? I don't know. But the Michael Brown case echoes of what we saw with George Floyd. And right now there is kind of a myth and a legend that is being built around George Floyd's death. And if the people don't get what they want, we're going to see what we saw back in 2014 with Michael Brown. We're going to see it. It's so much so that it has a name. I don't know if you've heard this before, but they call it the Ferguson effect. That if we don't get what we want, we will burn this thing down. You know, I hate to see it. I really don't want to see it. I don't want to see anything happen to Seattle. I don't want to see anything happen to Los Angeles. I don't want to see any of this stuff. But I'm getting the sense that that is the trajectory of all of this, and I find it to be so frightening. I find it to be so scary. Just as a commentator, and I can't figure out why for the life of me, why NBC, why ABC, why CNN, why MSNBC, why they're not just showing you all of the information? Why are they only showing you the prosecution slam dunks? Why are they only showing you the highlight reel? This is a procedure that takes something like 7 hours every day, 7-8 hours every single day. And you have people who are watching the news and they are getting the 4 to 7 to 8 minute distilled, homogenized, and contrived version of it. And they're not necessarily seeing all of the points which a member of the jury might say, oh, you know what? I have to consider that when I consider this case. I have to consider it. You understand their job is not to find a guilty verdict. Their job is to find justice, to distribute justice. So the amount of pressure that's placed on these people is so immense. I mean, can you imagine just being on that jury right now and having to make a decision with a clear mind and a clear heart as to what you are seeing unfolding in front of you? I couldn't imagine being there. And yet we're all still, you know, we're talking about it as if it is a done deal. And I will be surprised. I will be very surprised if it ends up being a guilty verdict for Derek Chauvin. I'll be beyond surprised at that point. I will be saying to myself, wow, something else contributed to this. Because at best, he's going to get a hung jury and possibly even acquitted. So I was talking about Vox earlier, right? There is this article that was written by Carl Hart. He's like a neuropsychological pharmacologist. Yeah, he refers to himself as a neuropsychopharmacologist. He also smokes heroin. And he is a guy who believes that all drugs should be legal, and he thinks that responsible adults should be able to do the drugs they want to do. He's very libertarian about it. But he wrote an article that said the claim that drugs killed George Floyd relies on a racist trope. Came out in Vox today. And he goes on to say about how, the amount of fentanyl that he had in his system was totally fine. And he was saying fentanyl is a totally acceptable drug that is FDA approved, and there's nothing wrong with it. As a matter of fact, his own wording is that he says that that this is all. Yeah, his blood also had 11 nanograms of fentanyl, America's latest vilified drug. Fentanyl, or its analogs that is laced with heroin or other drugs and is sold illegally for recreational use, can be very dangerous or deadly, but it's important that we don't fall prey to misinformed and dangerous myths about the drugs. I have done fentanyl. It is a very scary drug. It is a very heavy drug. A very small amount of it can kill you. Carl Hart, again, who is a doctor and he's a neuropsychopharmacologist, in writing this article, he is trying to portray it as if you would be racist for calling into question how George Floyd died. That you, if you were to come to the conclusion, as the jury might come to, that George Floyd died from a drug overdose, that would be a racist conclusion to come to. And so I ask you now, are we going to let the narrative get away from us, or are we going to have to look at the facts of the case? Are we going to just kind of let all of this steamroll over time, or are we going to just look at the facts of the case? Because when I look at the facts of the case, I think to myself, George Floyd was killed due to police malpractice. He needed Narcan. He needed medical attention. Was he killed by Derek Chauvin? I don't think so. I think he died as a result of his decision to ingest drugs in order to hide them from the police. And then the police decided not to give him Narcan and life-saving procedures. And why, I don't know. Why, I don't know. But what I will say this is that in talking about it, I think we need to be kind and empathetic and patient and not do this thing where we allow ourselves to get carried away with the narrative of what we would like of this idea of justice in the United States. I'm Jack Stein. We have to take a really quick break. When we get back, Rachel Bell will be in the studio with a whole lot more. We'll take a really quick break. We'll be right back after this. You can ring my bell. Listening to Cairo Nights. On the line right now is Rachel Bell, everybody's favorite Rachel Bell. Rachel Bell, before we get into the headline that you have for us this evening, I'm very curious. I have yet to hear about the new episode of Your Last Meal, my very favorite number one podcast that I listen to every single day, even back episodes. I can't go a day without listening to it. So
well, I hope you don't get past 101 days, because that's all the episodes that we have. So
okay.
Or I guess this is 102. Yeah, so if you've never listened to Your Last Meal, it's a podcast I do where I interview celebrities about what they would choose to eat for their last meal. And then I have other experts on to talk about either the history, the science, the culture of that dish. So I've been in this accidental blast from the past mode where my last episode was with Candace Cameron Bure, who was DJ Tanner in Full House. Yesterday, for a future episode, I interviewed Mayim Bialik from Blossom. And the new episode that just came out today is with perhaps North America's most famous children's musician. I was going to say museum. Raffi.
What?
Did you ever listen to Raffi, Baby Beluga?
Of course. How could I not? I listen to Raffi every day.
Wait, when you're not listening to my podcast, right?
Well, I listen to them both simultaneously. So I have a set of speakers going with your podcast, full volume, and then another set of speakers, Raffi, full volume. I am in the middle, in the lotus position, balancing a plate and a Siamese cat on top of myself.
Oh, wow.
And
that's perfect, actually, because it's kind of like how you're supposed to listen to the wall when you watch Wizard of Oz. We actually instruct people to listen to Raffi if you want to have a trippy experience listening to the podcast. So you're doing it right. So I'm not going to get super into it because we'll do that on Monday. But interview with Raffi. And then this is really exciting for me. So there's this new show on Netflix called Waffles and Mochi. And it's a kids show about food. And it's actually the first show that's produced by the Obama's new production company. So I have the creators of Waffles and Mochi on to talk about the show, but the way they got the show made is such a great story. And one of those stories that makes you want to, you know, pull out your dream from 20 years ago that you let die and pick it up again, because maybe the Obamas will help you make your dream a reality.
Hopefully.
It's such a good story. So listen to Raffi now, wherever you listen to podcasts, or at yourlastmealpodcast.com.
So what do you got for us in terms of headlines, Rachel Bell? Because I'm ready to dive right into this.
Okay, so little environmentalist me loves this story about Starbucks. They have this new borrow a cup program. I actually found this out myself in the fall. I don't usually go to Starbucks, but I was at the U Village and I went and I got a coffee, and they said, if you put down a dollar deposit, you can have this reusable cup and you just have to return it here and you'll get your dollar back. And I was like, oh yeah, of course. I always try to use reusable when I can. When I was talking to the people behind the counter, they said, oh yeah, they're just testing it at this store right now. And actually that barista back there, this was her idea, which I thought was so cool that they took a barista's idea up to corporate and were testing it out. So now they're testing it at 5 different Starbucks in Seattle, most of them in West Seattle. And just like what I said, you put down a dollar, you get this cup, you either bring it back to any Starbucks, or if you have one of those Ridwell bins on your porch, you can put it in there. The only negative, at least for me, as a not frequent Starbucks person, is you don't get the dollar back. You get a dollar in credit back. So if you go there all the time, then that's fine. You'll just get a dollar off your next drink. For me, I was like, I want my dollar.
It's a dollar.
And
also,
what am I? And I like lost the card for the credit because it's, I don't know, whatever. But I think this is great, except, you know, I don't think this would work if you're at the airport. You're not going to want to carry this cup around to try to get it back to a Starbucks. But if you're somebody who goes all the time, this is great. And they say that each reusable cup replaces up to 30 disposable cups.
Wow. When I lived in California, there was a little coffee shop in my neighborhood, and they had that same policy. But what I did, being a fool, is I walk into this coffee shop. I'm with a couple of friends of mine. We're visiting. We're hanging out. We're talking. I walk into this coffee shop, and on the wall, there is this huge rack with probably close to 100 separate individual mugs hanging from little hooks. And I say to myself, I'm looking around. I'm seeing all these people drinking delicious coffee beverages, and I say, oh, this makes sense. I take a mug off of the wall. I fill I fill it in the self-service. I put a dollar in the thing, and then I go about my merry way. Now, what I would eventually learn about 2/3 of the way through this process, thanks to an employee who noticed how foolish I was being and wanted to embarrass me in front of the entire coffee shop, was that those were actually mugs for reoccurring customers, and that I was actually in the act of theft, stealing somebody else's mug, which I thought that I would just fill self-serve and then put a dollar in the thing and then drink the coffee out of the mug. But instead, this fine lady with her bright pink hair and what do they call it when you shave the sides of your head and you're a lady? What do they call that?
Snake eyes.
No,
I don't know. Like,
that's a specific term for it. But she, with her kind of mohawk like hair, decided to embarrass me in front of everybody in the coffee shop, including my friends, and shame me actively for being a fool. And I will never forget that moment. And that is why I will not be doing this at Starbucks, Rachel Bell, because of the residual trauma I've experienced in my
PTSD?
life.
PTSD. Well, rest assured, none of these cups are hung on the wall. They have to give you one of them. So there will never be any shame involved.
Do you think that we are not going far enough in terms of reusables? Because for as right wing and as much of a right wing hack as I am, I love reusing glassware. The cups in my house are all glass. If I need to take a beverage somewhere, I take it in a mason jar like I'm a filthy hippie. You see what I'm saying? I really don't like plastics. I recycle as much as I possibly can. And I still feel like, again, in the brackets of being a right-wing hack, I still don't feel like we're doing enough individually to say, what can I cut down on my global impact?
Oh my God, 100%. I agree. And I'm glad that, you know, you feel that way, because just like we've been talking about the last couple of days about how the vaccine has become politicized, I don't understand why environmentalism is politicized.
Right.
Again, it's science. And, you know, it's not really hard to figure out that if you throw a bunch of stuff in the garbage, it's just going to be a big pile there that is not going to go away. So, I think it's just the fact of the way that our society is laid out. You get to live in these really nice, clean neighborhoods if you're lucky and privileged enough to do so, and not have to see that damage in front of your face. And so I think when things come up like that straw ban that came up, they very smartly tied that to, oh, you're killing, I don't remember the fish. What kind of fish?
Turtles, little turtles.
Oh, turtles.
Yeah.
People connect with that. Everybody stopped using straws. They were all on board. So I think you have to connect with people emotionally or monetarily. You know, there's not a lot of people. There's plenty of us, but there's not a ton of people like you or I who just care. We just care about it.
Yeah.
You kind of have to incentivize it. And so, you know, I don't think it becomes that much more expensive to use all compostable stuff. I mean, it's like, how many extra cents would be added on to the price of the drink? I think we have to. I mean, it's written on the non-compostable wall that we're just really killing this earth. And so I don't think it should be. That's the problem, is that it has been labeled this hippie thing, and there's identity wrapped up in it where they shouldn't be. It's just garbage. Let's treat it like garbage.
It's just hard for me. Like I saw an article in National Geographic about 5, maybe even 7 years ago about a village outside of Rio de Janeiro. Where,
good accent.
Thank you very much. Where these people subsist on the trash and the waste from a massive dump. And what they have done, because they're so poor, is they swim around in this trash river trying to find bits of scrap metal and gold and teeth and other things that people have thrown away to try to sell them. And from that day forward, I thought to myself, I don't want to live in a world where there are human beings swimming through a trash river trying to find teeth and gold that someone has flushed down the toilet. I just don't want to do it. So maybe that's what we need, Rachel Bell. We need to incentivize.
Yeah, it's true. And like that personal connection, because remember when Blackfish came out, you know, people stopped going to SeaWorld.
Yes.
Like, you know, if what you watched was shown to kids in school, they would go home and be like, Mom, we got to use mason jars, you know? and it has to be the big companies, because I do a lot of this quote zero waste stuff that's a misnomer. It's not zero, but like, you know, I only buy bar soap that doesn't come in a wrapper. Like, you know, I do all these little things, but that makes a bit of a difference. But big companies have to do it, because that's where all the big trash comes from. So think about how many million Starbucks cups are thrown away every day. Like, they have to do something about it. So the good news at the end of this story is that Starbucks in Korea has committed that all of their single-use cups will be compostable by 2025. And then Starbucks as a whole is trying to reduce their waste by 50% by 2030. But I think by then, there'll be a lot more options too.
Rachel Bell, we got to get out of here. We're almost going to blow right through the break. But I appreciate you very much. I appreciate you coming on, Rachel Bell. We have to take a really quick break. We'll be right back after this. All right, welcome back to Cairo Nights, where we used to all be friends who could share vulnerabilities with each other, but then someone had to break my trust. My trust. And use something against
me. It's not fair.
I had to use one of my vulnerabilities against me in a ruse.
Because I pooped on him and then he hit back.
So the good news is, Frank Shires, is that one in four U.S. adults is now officially vaccinated. And
really?
I think that this is fantastic. Yeah, in the United States, one in four United States adults is now vaccinated, and it's an amazing milestone. Something like 75% of seniors have received at least one dose of the vaccine. Mm-hmm. So with all of this in our minds, Frank Shires, with all of this kind of good news coming around, I wanted to take the time to ask you and Shane, on your last day here on Cairo Nights before I find a totally new crew, what will you miss, if anything? I've got two questions here.
Okay.
What will you miss, if anything, about COVID-19 is the first question.
Mm-hmm. And what's the other?
That's after we all answer it.
Okay.
Then I hit you with the 1-2.
What will I miss? When I used to have to drive in from Bellevue into the station every afternoon, starting at about, I'd leave at about, I had to leave at 5 o'clock because it would take me somewhere around 40 to 50 minutes to travel basically 17 miles. That ended the day the lockdown happened a year ago. And I've never had longer than a 17-minute commute into work for the last year. I will miss that. When that goes away, I'll be sad.
And then the other question is that what do you think you will always remember about COVID-19? And I will tell you that there was a good 2-week period when I used to live in California where I could run anywhere in the city that I lived in. I could run anywhere. And it was amazing because there was nobody out for about 2 weeks, maybe 3 weeks. Yeah. And it was so quiet that you could hear the birds again. And I would run without headphones so I could actually take in all the sound, this huge kind of natural orchestra out there. Mm-hmm. I was able to take it in again because nobody was driving and nobody was going anywhere. And now that has been totally ruined thanks to the vaccines. So another thing the vaccines have ruined for Jack Stein. Shane, will you miss anything about COVID-19? Is there anything out there that you think that you'll miss about the COVID-19 pandemic once it's all over?
No, there's nothing I'm going to miss about it. It took away my college graduation. It's taken away a lot of socializing and a lot of memories and times and trips that I was planning to go on with my friends. I saved up a couple $1,000s to go to Europe. That never happened. That's a car now. So if I would have had the opportunity, there was so many things that I had lined up. But the one thing to answer the second question, during the pandemic and during COVID, a lot of really great things happened to me in my life. I was able to graduate college with honors. I was able to get a job here and be able to stay up here in Washington. And, it's given me a lot of perspective in life. And I mean, I'm not going to miss this pandemic, not even one bit. But I will say, I don't know. It's kind of a weird thing for me. It's a love-hate thing because a lot of good happened and a lot of bad happened. So I'll just leave it at that.
Yeah,
I'll tell you that there's...
Oh, go ahead, Jack.
Oh, go ahead, Frank.
I was just going to say, I can echo what Shane said. My daughter missed the last 4 months of her senior year of high school.
No graduation,
no diploma ceremony, no senior prom. And it was heartbreaking. I felt so badly for her for that.
Frank, I've got a great idea before we have to get out of here.
Yeah.
When your daughter comes back, I will officiate the graduation ceremony, and Shane and I will put on a prom for you and the missus and the daughter, and it'll be great. Well, I'll just hang out in your living room, and we'll do it both in the same day.
Yeah, can we have a joint graduation ceremony? Like, can I get a diploma?
Shane.
I think we should.
This is only for Frank and Frank's family, Shane. Don't ruin it.
All right, damn.
We have to take a really quick break. When we get back, there is a Shane drop to end all Shane drops, and on top of that, we're going to be getting into a track coach who was fired for making the right decision when it came to cardiovascular activity. We'll take a really quick break. We'll be right back after this.